Our study this morning, brethren and sisters, will center in chapters 3 and 4 of Daniel, both chapters of which are dealing with the kings of Babylon and certain problems concerning the way they ruled. The proverb which we have quoted to be as the title for this class reads in its entirety from Proverbs chapter 16, verse 18, "Pride goeth before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall," which I feel is a fit sort of a summary of chapters 3 about Nebuchadnezzar's fall and chapter 4 of Belshazzar's fall. We have wondered about Nebuchadnezzar from time to time as to just how religious he was. It was unusual that a king, a foreign king of so much power, and a king over such false ideas as we find in Babylon, should be so interested, really, in God, and God seemingly so interested in him. And Daniel chapter 3 seems to be, or rather, chapter 4 seems to be a very decisive chapter in determining just how religious Nebuchadnezzar was. I think I've given you the wrong chapters. It's chapter 4 and chapter 5 we will be dealing with this morning. Now we know that we finished off chapter 3 after the witness of the three walking around in the furnace that had been put there, and then the one whom Nebuchadnezzar describes to be like the Son of God also in there. Just what he meant by describing him as the Son of God, I'm not sure. I can't imagine that he had any recollection or any image prior to this of what the Son of God would look like. Maybe it was just an expression to sort of match the grandeur of this person, and this was the resulting word that he could think of at the time. However, it seems much like Nebuchadnezzar. When he finishes that chapter, he makes a decree that every people, nation, and language which speak anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces. Nebuchadnezzar, greatly impressed by this spectacle he has witnessed in the fire, but yet not drawing proper conclusions. And we know how that in Daniel chapter 2, at the end of that chapter, he had mentioned similar things when he recognized that none of his men, all those people who were supposedly so wise, the Chaldeans who were so famous, all the magicians, the astrologers, couldn't interpret the dream, and yet Daniel did. And so he said in verse 47, "Of a truth it is that your God is a God of gods and a Lord of lords and a revealer of secrets, seeing thou couldst reveal the secret." So he recognized the power of God, but once again he didn't do the right things as a result of it. And so I feel the lesson in Daniel chapter 4 is a very notable one. It's one, brethren and sisters, that should come home to us. Because I feel that very often we make a similar mistake of testifying verbally to the glory and the strength and the magnitude of our God, but not living properly as a logical follow-up of that kind of a confession and that kind of a statement. And so Nebuchadnezzar, it would seem, was now going to send a witness to all the people that were under his rule of the wonders and the signs that the high God had wrought toward him. And he mentions in verse 3 of that fourth chapter how great are his signs, how mighty are his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion is from generation to generation. Now it may have seemed to us in studying Daniel that when Nebuchadnezzar was talking about the signs and the wonders, he was talking about the fact that Daniel had been able to interpret the dream before in Daniel 2, and of the great wonders that he beheld in the fiery furnace. However, after studying Daniel 4, I really don't think that's what he was referring to. After all, he didn't mention this when he was writing to all these people, the nations and languages of verse 1. He didn't even mention that. He mentioned something quite different. And I feel that if we can see the reason why Nebuchadnezzar saw such signs and wonders in Daniel chapter 4, we'll realize how that God humbled that man and made him see, I believe, via this process, the logical conclusion of saying that God is a God of gods. And so he tells about how in verse 4 he was flourishing in his own house and in his palace, and that he saw a dream which made him afraid, and the thoughts upon his bed and the visions of his head troubled him. And once again, calling to himself after he'd woken up the magicians, the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers, he told them the dream, but they couldn't make known to him the interpretation thereof. Now, I often wonder about that. And when you think of soothsayers and magicians and astrologers, and you go back and to consider how these people found anything out, I often wondered why some of them didn't venture to tell Nebuchadnezzar something that was wrong. Now, why did they really care to make sure that they knew the interpretation thereof? I don't know that there is an answer to that question. It may be that God was working on these magicians at this time to make sure that they were afraid to tell a lie at this particular time, whereas they might not have been some other time. For instance, if these were real magicians and Chaldeans, couldn't they put together a story to convince Nebuchadnezzar that this was the interpretation? But they didn't try to do that. And we know the outcome was that Daniel was held in high estimation over the magicians, and the elevation of the God of Daniel was held high in estimation over all the gods of Babylon. But it's an interesting question to consider in our mind as to why these people didn't try to answer the dream, even whether or not they had truth. However, at last comes Daniel before the king, and the king tells Daniel about the dream, and we might just refer to the main parts of this dream. In verse 10, he sees a great tree in the midst of the earth, and the height of it was great. And the tree grew and was strong, and the height thereof reached unto heaven, and the sight thereof to the end of all the earth. The leaves thereof were fair, and the fruit thereof much. And in it was meat for all. The beasts of the field had shadow under it, and the fowls of the heaven dwelt in the boughs thereof, and all flesh was fed of it. I don't think that would have ever troubled Nebuchadnezzar. He probably would have been, you know, quite pleased to see a dream like that. But what came after was what he didn't like. He saw in the visions of my head upon my bed, and behold, a watcher and an holy one came down from heaven. He cried aloud and said, "Thus, hew down the tree and cut off his branches, shake off his leaves, scatter his fruit, and let the beasts get away from under it, and the fowls from his branches. Nevertheless, leave the stump of his roots in the earth, even with a band of iron and brass, in the tender grass of the field, and let it be wet with the dew of heaven. And let his portion be with the beasts in the grass of the earth. And let his heart be changed from man's, and let a beast's heart be given unto him, and let seven times pass over him. This matter is by the decree of the watchers, and the demand by the word of the holy ones, to the intent that the living may know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will, and setteth up over it the basis of men." Well, you can now see by the latter end of that dream that Nebuchadnezzar had a reason for being troubled. It didn't seem like it was of the best of natures. It looked like something wasn't going to turn out that good, that something was going to happen, that people were going to be turned from a normal way of life to be like a beast. You don't know just exactly to what extent Nebuchadnezzar was able to interpret this himself. But when Daniel was told the dream, it says he was astonished for 1 hour, or he was temporarily stunned and stupefied, as we could read from that particular phrase. And Daniel was so because he knew that the dream's interpretation was not to the benefit of the king, but to those who hated him, to his enemies. And he interprets the dream, and he tells that this great tree was Nebuchadnezzar. And he goes over in the latter parts of this chapter to describe the various details of what would happen. He says in verse 4, "This is the interpretation, O king. This is the decree of the Most High, which has come upon my lord the king. They shall drive thee from men, and thy dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. And they shall make thee to eat grass as oxen, and shall wet thee with the dew of heaven, and 7 times shall pass over thee, till thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will. And whereas they commanded to leave the stump of the tree roots, thy kingdom shall be sure unto thee, after thou shalt have known that the heavens do rule." Now, I think it's very important in the understanding of the interpretation that the tree roots are of very great importance in the whole of the book of Daniel. It's something we will, God willing, deal with in later classes, that this particular tree of Babylon was not to be entirely destroyed. It was to be cut down, but the roots were to be left in the ground. And as we have in the actual dream itself, it was to be banded with a band of iron and brass. And I feel that, as we have mentioned, this is going to be of a major importance in understanding how that all of the prophecies of Daniel fit together. However, the immediate interpretation of this was that his kingdom, although it would be taken away from him, would be sure to him after a certain time. It says, "After that thou shalt have known that the heavens do rule." And so Daniel, after seeing this, makes a recommendation to the king. "Wherefore, O king," verse 27, "let my counsel be acceptable unto thee. Break off thy sins by righteousness, and thy iniquities by showing mercy to the poor, if it may be a lengthening of thy tranquility." No doubt, as we have testified in Daniel chapter 5, Daniel knew that the king was impressed by what happened in the fiery furnace. He knew how that the king had been impressed by the power of God. But he also knew that the king had never done anything about it other than be impressed. He had never changed his life. He still was not breaking off his sins and was not acting correctly as a response to saying that God is a God of gods. He wasn't showing mercy to the poor. And Daniel reckoned that if he could understand that this God, who is a God of gods, is a God of mercy, but a God of judgment, if Nebuchadnezzar could recognize that, it may be a lengthening of his tranquility, or as the margin renders it, a healing of thine heir. So Daniel advises the king now to do something about what he has confessed. That if this is a decree by the holy ones, and there was no God in Babylon or in Babylonia together that was holy, there was only one God, the God of the Hebrews, that claimed to be holy and pure. But if Nebuchadnezzar could only see that this decree was by the holy ones and do something as a result of that, in other words, be holy, not just impressed of power, then maybe there would be a lengthening of his tranquility. Surely Daniel felt there would be, or he would never express this, because he knew of the mercies and the favor of God. Well, we don't know whether or not Nebuchadnezzar did do something about this. He may have for a while, but it wasn't very long until the pride was boiling up within him again. And we know that as a result of this, the decree came that Nebuchadnezzar was to become like a beast. Now, the idea of a period of 7 times would seem, from the evidence, to be a period of 7 years. That for a period of 7 long years, Nebuchadnezzar was insane. He thought of himself as a beast. And he thought of himself such as a beast so that he acted in accordance with that. So I feel that this is why we can look to the verse 33 where it says he was driven from among men. He wasn't just thinking in his mind he was a beast. He was acting it out. He was dead on the floor, crawling around. And so they drove him out, and they made him eat grass as the oxen did. And his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till his hairs were grown like eagles' hairs, it would suggest, rather than feathers. It just ends there, were grown like eagles, and his nails like birds, or birds' claws. Now this must have been a fantastic thing, and I hope that we can put this together to see how that Nebuchadnezzar could reason after this the way he says he reasoned at the first of the chapter. It says in verse 26 that whereas they commanded to leave the stump of the tree roots, thy kingdom shall be sure unto thee after that thou shalt have known that the heavens do rule. Well, I don't think that Nebuchadnezzar would be trying to learn this for 7 years, especially trying to learn it as a person that's insane. But rather, God determined that he was to be insane for 7 years, and then, as he says himself, my understanding returned to me. Verse 36, at the same time my reason returned unto me. At verse 34, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted up mine eyes unto heaven, and mine understanding returned unto me, and I blessed the Most High, and I praise and honored him that liveth forever, whose dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation. So, rather than taking 7 years for Nebuchadnezzar to learn the lesson, I feel that he was insane for 7 years, and at the end of that time, he suddenly had his understanding returned to him. And it was at that time that then he praised and honored and glorified the God of heaven, and was able to say in sincerity that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will. And after that confession, then his kingdom was restored unto him. However, to get the full impact of it, I feel we must try to imagine this whole scene. We must try to imagine Nebuchadnezzar coming after 7 years suddenly to that recognition. You can see the picture we're given in verse 29. You know, Nebuchadnezzar may have did a bit of what Daniel said for a while, but at the end of the year, it says, he has walked on the palace of the kingdom of Babylon. The king spake and said, is not this great Babylon that I have built for the house of the kingdom of my might and my power and for the honor of my majesty? And there are inscriptions on the rocks to indicate that this was inscribed. This was the real true feeling of King Nebuchadnezzar. You can imagine him walking out in the palace, you know, and he looked out over all the things, and a fantastic city to behold. I mean, it was really impressive. When you think of the walls that Nebuchadnezzar had made up to 200 feet high, you know, and all of 40, 50 feet thick. You can imagine, oh, this is great Babylon that I have made, you know, and you can see him, you know, adjusting the crown on his head and pulling his garments up and his chest walking out as he walked around the rooftop of the palace, and he beheld the hanging gardens and the great ziggurat, and he looked over the whole big city, and he couldn't imagine how any man could ever pull that city down. He was really boasting in his pride. Look what I've done. And then suddenly, no, real suddenly, there's no one around, and a voice comes from heaven. And we find those words in verse 31. O King Nebuchadnezzar, to thee it is spoken, the kingdom is departed from thee. And they shall drive thee from men, and thy dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. And they shall make thee to eat grass as oxen, and 7 times shall pass over thee, until thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will. At the same hour it happened. Now I don't think that Nebuchadnezzar had a sane thought after that until 7 years later. His last sane thought was Nebuchadnezzar walking on the palace roof with his chest out and his garments on and his crown on his head and looking at Babylon and saying, is not this great Babylon that I have built? The next time he saw himself, here he was crawling in the grass. He looked at himself, and there wasn't any crown on his head, there wasn't any robes, there was long hair all over his body. And he looked at his fingers, and there was long nails like birds' claws. And he saw grass in his mouth and felt it. Now what would have humbled a man more than that? After imagining himself on the palace roof, the great Nebuchadnezzar building the whole of Babylon, and then looking at his hands and these big long nails and the hair that had gone long and shaggy and eating grass. Was this me, Nebuchadnezzar? Then he would have thought, because his understanding and his reason returned to him then. Then he would have thought that God had said this was going to happen. And you can imagine how that man's pride was crushed right into the earth. Surely if he'd been like that for 7 years, everybody knew about it. Everybody. He didn't have any pride anymore. How could he get up on the roof and boast that this was great Babylon he had built? Well, they take one look at him and they just laugh. Look at the claws he had and the long hair. And imagine eating grass like an ox. So he only had one thing to do. And he worshiped the God of heaven. And you can imagine that this must have really brought the God of heaven to the heart of Nebuchadnezzar. It must have really made an impression upon him that now here was a God really to be reckoned with. And so he praised the God of heaven and recognized that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men and giveth it to whomsoever he will. But, you know, I think that that's just part of the story. There's a fantastic exhortation in this for us. Here's a man whom you can imagine like almost no other man who could boast of things he had done and, you know, in a sense, could boast that he was involved in it, although he didn't recognize God's power behind it. And yet the wisdom of Solomon in Ecclesiastes 3, chapter 3, verse 8, was that God might manifest to men that they themselves are beasts. And here was Nebuchadnezzar beholding those big fingernails and the shaggy hair. He was a beast. God was manifesting to Nebuchadnezzar that he was just a beast. That's all he was to God. And if we, brothers and sisters, could only take this lesson to heart, and this is why the Word of God's here. As we find constantly we are referred to in God's Word that we would judge ourselves, that we should not be judged. We've got to imagine ourselves as Nebuchadnezzar, as ourselves boasting in pride and recognizing at the end of it that we are beasts. That's all we are. Everything we've gotten has come from God. If we can be humbled, brethren and sisters, by reading Daniel chapter 4, then obviously God does not have to chasten us like he has to chasten others who will not judge themselves. And so there's a tremendous value into looking at Daniel 4 and seeing that in God's sight we are beasts, and we best acknowledge that, lest our pride has to fall like Nebuchadnezzar's has to. I think that's only part of the story. Only part of it. I don't think that's what Nebuchadnezzar is referring to when he refers to the great signs and wonders that God did for him. Because you try to think now of what Nebuchadnezzar had been before and what he was going to become. He had been the sole ruler in Babylon. He was number one man. There wasn't a democracy. It was Nebuchadnezzar. That's all it was. Now what had happened in 7 years? Well, is there not going to be any man ruling in 7 years? Obviously, they're not going to let him rule, that fellow over there with the oxen. Who's going to be ruling in 7 years? And there's no mention of anyone ruling in 7 years. Obviously, something must have happened, and this would have brought the lesson, I think, really home to Nebuchadnezzar. He had to see that God was ruling in the kingdoms of men, and he gives it to whomsoever he will. And God said that he was going to give it back to Nebuchadnezzar. He said, after you acknowledge this, Nebuchadnezzar, your kingdom's going to be sure to you. And you can imagine the lords of Babylon. While Nebuchadnezzar was out in the pasture, looking at Nebuchadnezzar and looking at the long hair and the claws and a man eating grass, are they going to let that man come back and be king? Can you imagine what the American people would do if President Nixon suddenly thought he was a beast? And he walked out in the pasture and started to eat the grass, and his hair grew long and his nails grew like claws? How many American citizens would want a president like that? Isn't it just as much or even a greater miracle that after the man had been mad and everyone knew about it, that he came back on the throne? Surely I think this is what really impressed Nebuchadnezzar. That there wasn't probably a man in all of Babylon who wanted an insane man who thought he was a beast over that kingdom. And knowing the kind of men that were in control of Babylon and what happened after Nebuchadnezzar's death, boy, they were bloodthirsty. Why didn't somebody take the kingdom when he was out the pasture? Because God rules in the kingdoms of men, and he sets up over it whomsoever he will. And God had been preserving that kingdom for the time when Nebuchadnezzar would recognize he was God and he'd give it back to him. And I think that must have been fantastic to Nebuchadnezzar. Because no way, there was just no other way that that kingdom could have been secure outside of the fact that God has been ruling in the kingdoms of men when men couldn't do it themselves. That would have really brought it home to Nebuchadnezzar. And I think we have a fantastic lesson here of Daniel chapter 4, of God demonstrating to a man how that pride goes before a fall, of how that when God rules in the kingdoms of men, he does. And he does it in a miraculous way, not needing the help of man. And so I think we have a fantastic lesson for ourselves in Daniel chapter 4 and an equal one in Daniel chapter 5. In Daniel chapter 5, at the verses 1 to 6, we have a rough idea of what took place. And we'd like to just sort of scan over this. We find Belshazzar now, the king over Babylon, and he's making a great feast to 1,000 of his lords and drinking wine before 1,000. And Belshazzar, whilst he tasted the wine, commanded to bring the golden and silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple, which is in Jerusalem, that the king and his princes, his wives and his concubines might drink therein. Then they brought the golden vessels that were taken out of the temple of the house of God, which was at Jerusalem. And the king and his princes, his wives and his concubines, drank in them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and of silver, of brass and of iron, of wood and of stone. In the same hour came forth fingers of a man's hand and wrote over against the candlestick upon the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. Then the king's countenance was changed. His thoughts troubled him so that the joints of his loins were loosed and his knees smote one against the other. And he immediately cries to all the wise men of Babylon to bring them in. Look, what's going on here? And you can well imagine the man is terrified. Anybody would be terrified by seeing something like that. But here was something that even had a stronger influence than the wine. Because Belshazzar wasn't just sipping the wine. The idea of this is being warmed by the wine. And he might have been pretty warm by that time after drinking it before thousands of his lords. But here was something stronger than the influence of wine, and it was that man's hand writing on the wall. And you can imagine the terror which would have been in the hearts of everyone that would saw that handwriting. So the familiar expression we have today, the handwriting is on the wall. You know, it was something they could see, and there was an omen of evil about this. And so King Nebuchadnezzar, with all the slowing down that alcohol might do to a person, it didn't slow him down. His knees got loosed, and they started to shake. And it was a matter of a great trembling. And I think there's a real spiritual parallel in Daniel chapter 5 that we can see after we've concluded the main events of the chapter. Well, once again, the magicians, the astrologers, let the king down. They just couldn't make out this writing. You know, it's interesting how that God worked with the kings of Babylon. You know, why did God let Nebuchadnezzar have the dream of chapter 2? Here was a fantastic dream of major importance to all of history. Why didn't he reveal it to a Hebrew prophet? Well, it may be because at the time Israel, as a nation, was in total disrespect of their God. They had been carried away captive, as we mentioned day one, because of their wickedness and their utter abhorrence of the principles and laws of God. So that God revealed this through a pagan king, but made that pagan king know that if he wanted to know the interpretation of the dream, he had to recognize the authority of the Hebrew God. A very interesting thing, I think, to recognize the way God works. And so in every single case, they did not know the interpretation of these things, and they had to go to a power and recognize the power of the God of Israel to be supreme. And so this Belshazzar doesn't even know Daniel. Now, it says he was Nebuchadnezzar's son, but the word means ancestor rather than literal son. And if anyone can make out all the kings of Babylon, it would seem that he was a grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. But he was close enough in terms of time to have known what happened in Daniel chapter 4, as we find Daniel referring to this later in this chapter. And so we find the queen in verse 10 has to come to Belshazzar and tell him of Daniel. Tell him of how Daniel had been able to foretell the meaning of dreams that Nebuchadnezzar had. And so I get a rather humorous picture of verse 12 here, because it seems, oh, I don't know, it's just the way the King James expresses it, but it is interesting language when it says, "For as much as an excellent spirit and knowledge and understanding and interpreting of dreams and showing of hard sentences and dissolving of doubts were found in the same Daniel." And this expression of dissolving of doubts, I think, is a very peculiar one to describe the things that Daniel had done, how he had, you know, just the doubts were vanished as to whether that was the interpretation of the dream. Daniel had, you know, an answer for every part of it. So completely had God revealed it to him that they described it as a picture of a dissolver of doubts. Well, Daniel wasn't very happy. In fact, there's no doubt about that. The verses show that he gave Belshazzar a very great dressing down. We find in verse 17, "Then Daniel answered and said before the king, 'Let thy gifts to be to thyself, and give thy rewards to another. Yet I will read the writing unto the king, and make known to him the interpretation.'" But he doesn't start to make the interpretation until quite a long time after. What he's going to do is he's going to tell this king exactly what God thinks of him. "O thou king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar thy father a kingdom, a majesty and glory and honor. And for the majesty that he gave him, all people, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would he slew, and whom he would he kept alive. And whom he would he set up, and whom he would he put down. But when his heart was lifted up, and his pride hardened, his mind hardened in pride, he was disposed from his kingly throne. And they took his glory from him. And he was driven from the sons of men, and his heart was made like the beasts, and his dwelling was with the wild asses. And they fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till he knew that the Most High God ruled in the kingdom of men, and that he appointeth over it whomsoever he will. And thou, his son, O Belteshazzar, hast not humbled thine heart, though thou knewest all this, but hast lifted up thyself against the Lord of heaven. And they have brought the vessels of his house before thee, and thou and thy lords and thy wives and thy concubines have drunk wine in them. And thou hast praised the gods of silver and gold and brass and iron and wood and stone, which see not, nor hear, nor know. And the God in whose hand thy breath is, and whose are all thy ways, hast thou not glorified. Then was the part of the hand sent from him, and this was the writing therein." And we know that that led to the end of Belshazzar's rule. Verse 30, "And that night was Belshazzar the king of the Chaldeans slain." Well, it's interesting to see how that Daniel's dressing down to him was based on this, that he knew of God's supremacy. He knew of what happened to Nebuchadnezzar. Why didn't he see the result, the logical result, of the great humbling of Nebuchadnezzar, as Nebuchadnezzar himself did? And Daniel tells him, "You haven't humbled yourself, but you've lifted up yourself in pride against the Lord of heaven. What have you done? You've done this. You've brought the vessels of the house of Yahweh of Israel, And you've desecrated them. You've brought them into your banquet. You've drank wine out of the vessels of the God of heaven, out of this great God that Nebuchadnezzar said was the God of gods. You haven't humbled yourself, Belshazzar. You're haughty in your spirit. He says further, did you have worshiped gods of wood and of stone and of iron? He says, you haven't even used your senses, Belshazzar. You ought to know that there is no life in gods of wood. Hasn't it been visibly demonstrated before you in the mighty things that have been done by the God of Israel in Babylon? And yet you have disregarded all this. You've disregarded the fact that the very breath that's in your body has come from the God of heaven. But you never glorified him. And so we find that Belshazzar is thoroughly condemned. And that night he dies. I think there's a fantastic exhortation there, brethren and sisters. He should have known. And how much is there before us that we should know? Hasn't God set before us in Romans chapter 1, verse 18 to 20, sufficient evidence that even apart from the Bible, God says that his power, his invisible power, is visible in what he has made? As we mentioned earlier, if you reason and just think about your own finger, you must reason about the power of the one who created it. And how could one then bow down to worship gods of wood and stone? How could one's life be absorbed in things which are of no value or consequence, when at the same time God says, you're without excuse before me because you see the evidence of my power in everything that you behold? He says further to us, brethren and sisters, he says that God has appointed a day in which he's going to judge the world in righteousness by that man whom he hath ordained, even Christ Jesus. And he says the assurance of this is that he's raised him from the dead. God takes that for fact. We must as well. We must live differently because Jesus Christ rose from the dead, so that no one could come to us at the judgment seat and say, didn't you know that Jesus Christ rose from the dead? Why didn't you live differently because of it? That's what God's telling us when he mentions that in Acts 17, verse 31. Not that he's just given us some assurance that is sort of outside of any meaning to us, but that when he gives you that kind of assurance, you must do something about it. And what Belshazzar should have done was he should have humbled himself. He should have broke off his sins by righteousness. He should have looked after the poor of the land. It may have been a lengthening of his tranquility, but he didn't see it that way. He forgot the mighty works of God. He considered them of no importance. And when we see this Word of God itself, the power of the Bible itself, brethren and sisters, you can't reason about that book in any other way than to think that that is a literary miracle right before your and my eyes. You want a miracle? There it is, right before our eyes. You can't just leave that book alone because of that. We stand responsible to God for the book itself, because if we think about it and we reason about it, it will lead us in a reasonable way of life, as Paul himself says in Romans chapter 12, that when you think of all the evidence God has given us, when you think of the things he's done for us, there is a reasonable service as a result of it. There is a logical outcome to this. It should result in people honoring this great God whom we worship in the way that they live. And I think there's another lesson, brethren and sisters, when we contemplate the Lord's coming, of how that it overtook Belshazzar at a time when he was drinking. His time was up. There he was enjoying himself. There he was feasting with his lords. There he was in a moment of intoxication, maybe, doing some things he would not have done if he had been more sober. But the intoxication, brethren and sisters, that we're interested in doesn't just come from wine. We know what the Lord tells us about in Luke chapter 21, of how that the cares of this life, the deceitfulness of riches, all have the same effect on our mind as the intoxication of liquor. We've got to make sure that we are thinking crystal clear at times as momentous in history as we are observing today. We know our Lord is at the door. Dare any of us be caught like Belshazzar was, feasting around wine, intoxicated, desecrating the holy things of God, not doing what he ought to have done, which was boldly and very easily ascertainable before him from things that he had witnessed? I think, brethren and sisters, when we behold the verse that we find in 1 Corinthians chapter 6 of the Apostle Paul, that there's a lot more to this verse than is meant in just the context that he gives it to us. Verse 12, "All things are lawful unto me, but all things are not expedient. All things are lawful unto me, but I will not be brought under the power of any." And we know, brethren and sisters, that we live in a time of life when all things that would seem, or I shouldn't say all things, but a great number of things that are lawful are not expedient. When the Lord Jesus Christ condemned Sodom, he condemned them for buying, for selling, for planting, for building, for marrying, giving a marriage. It seems to be things that have to be done. But they were being done at the exclusion of things which ought to have been done first. And when we look at 1 Corinthians chapter 6, sure, there's things which are lawful. There are things which it seems we must do. But there are things which are not expedient, too. We've got to make sure, brethren and sisters, that as the world presses in on us in the way of occupations, where this world is now seem to be involved in such a competitive spirit, that if a man's going to survive at work, he's got to show that same competitive spirit to voluntarily work overtime, to voluntarily take his mind and his energy and his resources and apply them to his daily work. It's time to say it's not expedient. It's lawful, but not expedient. We're living in the last days when our minds must be crystal clear, when we must exhort one another so much the more when we see the day approaching. And when we talk about drugs last night, there's all kinds of other things that drug us, brethren and sisters. There are things that go into the body via the mouth. There's all things that go into the body via the ears and via the eyes. And I dare say that one of the biggest things we've got to contend with is our TV sets. It's our magazines. It's our newspapers. It's our radios. It's one thing to be able to control that dial. It's something else to control the mind's dial later on. You might be able to shut the program off so you're not watching it visually. Can you turn it off in your mind when you're doing the readings? Is not this whole Christian life about mind control? And how does your TV help you to control your mind, let alone your time? How does the books and the magazines we read help us to control our mind? Will we be in mind intoxicated like Belshazzar was when the handwriting comes, when Jesus Christ comes? Is he going to come to us as a thief? Brethren and sisters, these are lessons for us to learn by. They're fantastic lessons that if we take them to heart, if we really see that they're not just talking about Nebuchadnezzar or Belshazzar, but you and I, then maybe we will be spared from the great embarrassment of those two men.